This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 272 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
The holidays are just around the corner. How's your holiday shopping going, Sam?
I've considered thinking about looking into it.
Okay, you guys, what that means is she's prepared her list. Usually what happens, and I can't speak for some, but usually what happens is about this time of year, actually, honestly, I probably wait every year until after Thanksgiving. Once Thanksgiving is done, I can go whole hog into Christmas with the decorations and the music and the this and the that. And I say, okay, let's lay out a plan for all the people I'm going to buy for. And then I write down the stuff. And then if someone has a list, I ask for the list and that makes it golden. But whatevs. It can be a struggle to find the perfect gift for someone you love.
For a really special gift for the special people in your life, you've got to check out Canvas People. Canvas People prints your favorite memories on canvas and turns them into unique works of art that add a beautiful touch to your home.
So Summer and I have both had the chance to get a print made through Canvas People. And if I'm not mistaken, I know I copied you, but didn't we get the same print?
Oh, yes, we did.
It was a beautiful picture of the
Kilmartin Glen.
Kilmartin Glen in Scotland from our 2015 trip. Oh my gosh, the bluebells, a carpet of woodland bluebells. It was ridiculously gorgeous.
And Canvas People prints are also great for decor. Their prints are like pieces of art. With Canvas People, you get your favorite memories printed to cherish and beautiful prints that look great on any wall.
Now, as a special, very limited holiday offer, CanvasPeople.com is offering their popular 11 by 14 photo canvases for free. That's right, free. These normally sell for $69.99, but for this week only, you'll pay nothing. Just cover shipping and handling.
To get your free canvas, text Outlander to 797979. Just pay shipping and handling. This offer won't last, so text Outlander to 797979. That's Outlander 797979.
Message and data rates may apply. And now we have our listener feedback from 402. So this is you guys. You let us know what you thought. First up, Eileen P.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Eileen P. from Melville, New York. Maria Doyle Kennedy nailed it as Jocasta. While she seems serene, under the surface, she is calculating. Watch as she uses that Mackenzie slyness by publicly announcing Jamie as her heir before even discussing it with him. Her brother Cullum would be proud. Then see her use Farquhar Campbell to set Jamie straight about his desire to free River Run's slaves. Jocasta is cool as a cucumber, reacting as if this is the first time she's heard of these laws. Notice that she avoids being the messenger. Jamie can direct his frustration at the laws, at Farquhar, and at the colony of North Carolina, but not at Jocasta, because she seems like she is entertaining his suggestions. Though in the end, it doesn't really matter. Jamie recognizes the complex barriers built to ensure slavery endures. They are insurmountable for him and Claire. To drive the point home, we have Claire trying desperately to save Rufus from his barbarically inflicted wound, only to find her actions have endangered the other slaves, and indeed all of River Run. While we have met Ulysses and Phaedra, it is hearing the story of Rufus that brings tear pricks. Knowing he was taken from his family, hearing of a sister taken at the same time, but where is she? If Jocasta purchased the slaves in lots so that families could stay together, why wasn't Rufus's sister at River Run? Did Jocasta lie? As Claire aided Rufus's death, I cried for his loss. He was the Elias Pound of Do No Harm. However, it is when his lifeless body is dragged and lynched by the torch-bearing mob that I thought they don't even know if he's dead or alive, and it would make no difference in their actions. They need to brutally kill Rufus to deter any slave uprisings. By doing so, they protect themselves and ensure slavery endures.
So thank you very much, Eileen. Next up is Jacqueline P.
Hi, this is Jacqueline P. I'm calling from Miami. I just wanted to say that there was really a feeling of creme de menthe in the third season of the guy that fell and hit his head and then Claire tried to fix him up. It was the same feeling. I don't know if Summer or Ginger talked about this on the podcast, but it was the same exact feeling. I felt the same thing with her getting there and trying to, you know, with the slave and Rufus and that whole scene. I felt exactly the same way. And the other thing is, yeah, we really don't want to see Jamie with the bangs. Not good. Not good.
I've been hearing that a lot.
This is Jacqueline from Miami again. I forgot one little thing.
Oops.
The wigs on everybody, on Jocasta, on Claire, you can see the line from the head. You can see that it's a wig. I don't know. It's terribly done, I think. That was it. I forgot to tell you that.
She called back. The wigs are important, Summer.
I know, but I don't want to get mired down in talking about wigs.
No, but a lot of people have commented on the bangs.
I know. The bangs. I mean, yeah, I'm not a fan of the bangs.
Next up, Jenny S.
Hello, Jenny S. here from Salt Lake City, Utah. Really enjoyed episode 402. Thought it was very well done. Especially enjoyed meeting Aunt Jocasta. The character was actually quite a bit more subtle than I expected. I don't know what I was picturing in my head, but it was really perfect. I was quite taken with her. And I thought the moment when Jamie was talking to Claire about his mother was very touching. Evidently, Jocasta is quite a bit like Ellen. And meeting Jocasta was tantamount to Claire having been able to meet Jamie's mother. And it got me really just curious. What about Murta? We have not seen him. We don't know if we will, but if he comes into the picture, he was in love with Ellen. And him interacting with Jocasta, the idea of that is very interesting to me. I just want to see that. I think they might really hit it off. Anyway, that's my thought. Thanks. Bye.
What if he never comes back to the show? What if they only had him go to the States and the colonies because they didn't want anybody else to kill him? What if the writers wanted us to all think that there's a possibility that he is off living his Murtaugh life? And that way he never meddles in the current timeline, so he can't mess up for future books. But he could be off living some Murtaugh-fastic, fantastic life in the colonies.
A lot of fans will be upset or disappointed, but that's a distinct possibility.
Well, what they did say specifically was that Murtaugh did not replace Duncan. I did remember reading that.
From what I understand, we may still get Duncan, just obviously not in the same fashion. Next up is Jennifer.
Hi, this is Jennifer from Oregon. I am a first-time caller. First, I think that Ginger mentioned that Ulysses, She talked about Ulysses' accent and thought maybe that in the books that he had a Scottish accent, but I don't think that's the case. I think it was a groom, Josh the groom, that had the Scottish accent, if I'm remembering correctly. So just wanted to point that out. Also, love Jocasta. I thought that her facial response when Jamie kind of schooled Wolf in matters of grain, rice versus wheat, that her facial expression was pretty, modern. She kind of opened her eyes really wide, and I'm like, huh, I never would have thought that facial expression was, you know, part of that time period, but who am I to know? So anyway, that was an interesting part for me. In that same theme, I loved Claire's dress, the red one with the white lace. Oh my gosh, gorgeous. Oh, I didn't miss the Jocasta's yarn in balls on the table. That was something that really stood out to me from the books, and that was great that they included it. I didn't notice any pictures, any beautiful scenic paintings in River Run. Maybe I just missed them, but that was just an interesting thing that maybe wasn't included. I know that there were some folks who left messages on Facebook that talked about having maybe some African-American representation in the writing room for this episode. And, you know, the episode, my first time I watched it, there was nothing that struck me. But the more I thought about it after I'd read, like, there was a TV Guide article that talked about having, you know, a different perspective on the slavery backdrop. American fans of Outlander weren't super happy about the way that the episode went down. And at first, as a white person, I did not that didn't strike me. But after I read a TV Guide article that somebody posted in the Facebook feed for episode 4, did think after I watched it again, and I thought, well, yeah, I see the point, and I think that having maybe more African-American input in the writer's room might have changed the episode a little bit. I think maybe keeping it closer to at least the issue with the hook and the surgery, that maybe should have been more like it was in the book. That might have helped a little bit. I don't know. But anyway, I just thought that was an interesting point. You can't go back and change an episode that maybe for the future, for other shows, that maybe that's an important thing to keep in mind. And thank you, Ginger and Summer, for your work on the podcast. I know it's probably more of a labor of love than anything else, and it's kind of fun having a book club that we, or a TV show club that we can all talk about. So thank you for facilitating that. Over now.
Thanks, Jennifer. I think you said it was your first time calling in. We love hearing from you. Definitely, definitely there were thoughts, opinions about how episode 2 depicted the introduction, not the introduction of slavery, but the introduction of slavery to the show. Next up is Keisha.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Keisha calling from Odenton, Maryland. I just wanted to say that these first two episodes of Outlander season 4 are the setup. I'm a book reader, so I kind of know what's going to happen, and I just am happy to see it play out on TV. I want to give the directors and the writers a chance to show me what they can do. I'm not going to be too critical at this point. I'm just going to say that this is the setup, and we only have so many episodes to the end of this season. So I'm just going to sit back, relax, and watch. I loved seeing Jocasta. Ulysses wasn't as stoic as I thought he would be, but we'll see how it goes. You know, Claire's Claire. She's a 20th century woman, and, you know, we can't ask for anything less. We always know she can do lots more. So thanks. Enjoy the podcast, and can't wait to hear your thoughts on the next episode, 403. Thank you.
Thanks, Keisha. I can't speak for Summer, but I think she agrees. And that's kind of the reason we don't want to go off in the woods with things like hair and makeup or costumes. You know, recognizing something or saying, oh, you know, I really liked her outfit is different than going down the road of harping on something more than just a comment's worth. And to your point, all this to say, we have so few episodes in the season compared to a normal, primetime television show, obviously. Although we are lucky to have 13. A lot of shows have like 8 or 6 or 10. But because of the limited number of episodes that we know we have, especially those of us who have read the books know approximately what to expect and where they need to be. Like Summer said, at the end of Voyager, did they get us where we needed to be? Yes. At the end of Dragonfly, here we go again. At the end of Drums, will they get us to where we need to be? I have full faith because they've done it 3 years in a row or 3 seasons in a row. So yeah, definitely they've still are world building in episode 2. Other than the fact that we do get behind the mic and talk about it, yes, I am looking forward to just letting the season unravel. Sounds a little negative. Unroll.
That's not, and I would say unravel is the way.
Unravel to me seems like something is coming
but
apart.
But it's not just that. It's not just, it's to see how, well, maybe how it all comes together.
Yes, how it all comes together, how the rest of a season is revealed, all that. Yeah, so I definitely take your point, Keisha. Next up, Linda G.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Linda G here. So this episode, probably the most heart-wrenching episode I had to endure. Claire may be our chaos monster, but for me, she was amazing. She was not feeling slavery, and neither was I. I literally fell head over heels with young Ian, just watching him watch Claire while performing the surgery that took my breath away, not to mention his curiosity of the Indian women. Oh, boy, lots to look forward to. Aunt Jocasta was spot on. A little deviation from book was noticed, like the Mad Mob. But regardless of what some think of how Jamie acted in this episode, to me, he'll always be the king of men. I think Rufus did an amazing job, and I had more than a tear prick during his time on screen, believe me. Overall, I did like the episode and look forward to what's coming next. Thanks, Ginger and Summer. Glad we are back for the feedback. Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Linda G. And I have to say, first of all, thank you for using tear prick. I know Summer hates that. Oh, Summer's like, internally, no, it's not a thing.
I feel like I'm. Anyway. I feel like I am. What is it? What's the name of the character? Regina George in Mean Girls, who turns to Gretchen and says, stop trying to make fetch a thing.
There you go.
So, Ginger, stop trying to make tear prick a thing.
Hey, if other people are using it, I don't have to try.
It hurts my feelings. It's already a thing.
It might be two people in the world. But it's a thing. Okay. So yeah, I thank you for using tear prick, Linda. And yes, I am super glad the show is back. Of course. Yeah. I liked hearing what you said. I can completely see how someone might consider episode 402 their most heartbreaking. So yeah, 402 was definitely heartbreaking. And I love that she pointed out that she fell in love with young Ian as he was just watching Claire do her surgery. Next up, Martina P.
Hello and guten Abend. This is Martina calling from the closet in Alaska.
It is a closet.
Fun summer. Episode 4-2, I really enjoyed it. River Run set took my breath away and so did the costumes. All the new characters are so good. I can't rave enough about their skills. They're just all such good actors. I did love the very first scene between Jamie and Aunt Jocasta. I really enjoyed their arrival at River Run. It was so sweet and emotional. I had a little bit of trouble with Claire in this episode, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I might be a little unfair, but I thought that she was pouting throughout the whole episode. And I also think she should have been a little bit more sensitive to the culture and the way of life of that time. Her judgmental attitude towards Jamie's aunt was a little problematic for me. When you meet your in-laws for the first time, you would think you would want to make a good impression, but I don't think Claire was worried about this at all. I did love John Quincy Myers and Ian exchange about the Indians and the hairy balls. It was so funny. And another thing I didn't quite understand is that Jamie usually has a handle on things, but he seemed clueless, just like Claire. He usually is the one who explains things to Claire and educates her, but not here, and it didn't make sense to me that he wasn't in charge of the situation. Phaedra's comment about Claire's breasts were quite funny, especially when she was wearing a dress that made her look completely flat-chested, like a teenage boy. The writers really want to please the readers with those beautiful lines from the book, and I really appreciate it. So next episode, Roger and Bree, very excited. Auf Wiederhören und gute Nacht.
Thank you, Martina.
Is she going to work balls and breasts into every feedback?
Oh, Lord. word. Now that you said it, probably so.
I think, okay, the only thing that I have to say about that is that she said she was disappointed in Jamie, but you have to remember that he's also a fish out of water. They're both fish out of water. So neither of them knows how to deal with 18th century colonial America. So it's not, if they were back in Scotland and he was in, you know, his home territory, I think he definitely would have a complete and total handle on the situation. But where he's now, he's totally fakety, make it ing right. Make it ing right now.
Next up.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Melissa from New Jersey. So I really loved, and I know Ginger will like this one, I really loved that that Claire and Jamie's theme plays while Jamie is talking about how he has nothing. And there's a certain level of, I want to say it's dissonance, but Ginger, you could probably tell me much better than I can. But if there's a certain level of dissonance that happens during that theme at the very end when he's talking about how he has nothing to offer her. And she's saying, well, you know, no, it's okay. I married you with nothing. And I just thought that was such a great moment music-wise from Bear. So I thought that was really a wonderful moment. Another thing that I really, really loved, and just picking out random things from the show, but one of the things that I really loved is when Ian was talking and he said, what are they like, the Indians? And I started laughing and I said, foreshadowing. And after that, I really liked the whole dress discussion with Phaedra and Jocasta and Claire. And I love Jocasta and I love Phaedra. I love the whole dynamic. I thought that was really great. And it was like straight from the book. So I thought that was so awesome. They kept that. Also, I have to say, it reminded me so much of The Devil's Mark, straight from The Devil's Mark, when I saw Jamie wielding the two guns and standing up for Claire as she was standing up for the boy that was on the hook. So I love the fact that Jamie still has that fire in him to protect and do what's right. And it's just such a great thing that hasn't changed over these years, that he is still that fiery, and it's wonderful. And also, I love Claire and Ian's relationship, especially during the surgery scene. It's just, it's so wonderful to see the dynamic between the two of them. It's wonderful. I really like what both of them are doing as actors, and I just really like how the writers are really taking Jamie and Claire Ian and Claire and really establishing that relationship. It's really wonderful. Also, I have to say that I love the parallels between all the different characters of the Mackenzie clan. Like, I saw so much in Jocasta, Dougal, and also Cullum, and I thought that was really, really cool. So I really loved her characterization of Jocasta. Can't wait to see more. Loving everything. Love you guys. Thank you for everything that you do. I love this podcast, and I'll speak to you soon. All right. Have a great one.
That's two people now who have pointed out how much they loved Ian during the surgery scene. I watched it. I enjoyed him. I enjoyed it, but it didn't really, really stand out to me. So that's awesome. I like hearing different things than I caught. Next up is Michael M.
Howdy, Ginger. Howdy, Summer. This is Michael from Shawnee, Kansas. The only thing I want to cover in this review is the surgery. In the show, Claire removed the hook from Rufus. In the book, she repaired a hernia on John Quincy Meyer that looked like a third testicle. The thing that I think that the show missed in the book surgery was the audience that Claire had to witness her skills as a doctor so that they may talk about it and tell all their neighbors and so forth. Also, I really would have liked to have seen Claire ready with fork in hand to jab Philip Wiley as a distraction before Aunt Jocasta could name Jamie as an heir. That's all I have for now. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting comment about how he didn't say, oh, we lost the ball surgery. He just said, okay, they made a change. But one of the things that they didn't include was, and you probably didn't want it in this circumstance or in this situation, but the one thing this scene, besides the different person, missed was the audience. And the purpose of the audience in the book was to, as he said, spread the word about, oh my gosh, this woman, like, cut off his ball, or, you know, and right on the dinner table. I mean, the shock, the horror, again, helping, not really wonderfully, spread her reputation as a wackadoodle healer. So that's interesting. So this, the change in the show won't help spread her the word as a wackadoodle healer, but I think it will definitely, because of the circumstances and the angry mob outside, it will definitely help spread her reputation as a sympathizer, which might even be worse. And finally, Susanna M.
Hello, everyone. My name is Susanna M., and I'm from Lisbon, Portugal. I have three things to say. I love the fact that Phaedra has a Scottish accent. In the books, Claire talks about the fact that all the slaves have a Scottish accent. I don't remember what she says about Ulysses, but it didn't seem odd to me that he had a regular American accent. I've missed seeing Jamie in a kilt, and probably not for the same reasons as most ladies. I thought that him wearing it again after more than 20 years would make him regain his pride, not only as a Scotsman, but also as a free man. The third thing I want to talk about is seeing Jocasta knit. Loved it since I'm a knitter myself, and that I found Outlander because of the knitted garments everyone was talking about. I hope to see Ian and Jamie teaching Claire to knit. I have one more thing to say. I love your show, and I hope you keep doing it for a really long time.
Aw, thank you, Susanna. We... Summer has pretty much locked me in for a really long time.
Diana has, because she keeps writing books.
Nope. Diana can write for 30, 50, 80 more years. Summer's the one who has said that, who got me to promise to do all the books. Even if the show ends and we don't even get any more series, Summer and I have agreed to do read-alongs for all the books.
So you're welcome, listeners.
Or at least Susanna is welcome. The rest of them may not care.
They're like, stop.
Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy.
Using the Robinhood app doesn't cost anything, and there are no commission fees. As a stock market noob, meaning I absolutely know nothing about the stock market, you go into one of these things and you're like, how do I know what to pick? How do I know who to trust? How do I know the best things to go for? And what's the best bang for my buck? What's great about the Robinhood app is that you can search for it. If you already know what you're looking for, you can search by keywords. They also have them listed by the top 100 stock markets, or the fastest growing, or the ones to watch. And if you're looking for anything in particular, you can search for it, like I said. And when you click on it, it gives you all kinds of information about the stock. So it's the link to articles about the stock that have been written about it. There are ratings as to whether or not, you know, if it's been trending down, why they think it'll turn around, whether or not it's a good buy, why it's a bad buy. And it really, it not only makes you feel comfortable using the app, but I also feel like it kind of educated me a little bit about how the stock market works. And to keep in theme with our podcast, I am now the proud owner of exactly one share of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. Trade stocks and keep all your profits. It has easy to understand charts and market data. Place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone.
Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at outlander.robinhood.com. That's outlander.robinhood.com.
Is it time?
It is time.
All right. Now on to our discussion of episode 403 entitled False Bride.
Okay, before we get started, we have two new little, I can't even say a segment because hopefully it's not going to take long. It's just more of a quick chit chat. Okay, I'll go first. On a scale of robot to tear prick, I had a 2. What about you?
I don't tear prick. You're asking silly questions.
All you got to say is robot. Because you're a robot. Now, also, that was the scale I wanted. The other one that you did twice that I'm bringing forward as a regular thing is telegraph much? Was there anything in this episode that you thought was heavily telegraphed?
No, I don't think this one was that bad. And bad is really the wrong word. I don't think that this one dealt in too much telegraphing. It was not hitting me over the head with wedding rings from the first opening sequence.
Second?
Yeah.
Okay, so are we ready to dive in?
I've been ready.
Okay, so I can say the opening, and again, not the visual. The visual's fine. The music, the song, all that. It's definitely growing on me. I am becoming more used to it now. Still not my favorite, but I don't like almost hate it anymore. I never hated it all the way to the end, but yeah, the banjo bit. I'm getting used to it. It's much less like shocking now. I'm still not a fan of the end where they go, to sky. Okay, no, that's not my thing.
I'm not a fan of you doing that.
Me either, because I hate
it. So you should just stop.
Okay. So, but what I will say is when they get to sky, that part, it didn't sound as brash as last time, which means, I can't say it's growing on me. I'm getting used to it. So it's not as shocking anymore.
I think you should just fast forward.
I can't. It's our show.
And stop harassing us with how it's growing on you.
The writer of this episode was Jennifer Yale, and it was directed by Ben Bolt. The opening title card was a wicker stag. Stick stag. I don't know. It was a lot of big wicker.
It was wicker. It was a wicker stag. I did some looking up on that because I was like, I have not.
It reminded me of that wicker man.
It did. I have been to many Scottish festivals, but I could not. I've never stayed to the end. So I don't know if they've ever had a stick stag that they've lit on fire. But I looked online and I couldn't find one associated with a Highland game, but I did see that they were associated with Hogmanay, burning a wicker stag.
A stag?
Yeah, a wicker stag. Wow. So that's the most I could find about it. But when I saw it in the beginning, I was like, I think it's flammable. They probably are going to burn it. But I couldn't right away place what it was going to be until, you know, when it came full circle at the end.
So when you first saw the wicker stag, before you looked it up, did you say like, what the hell?
Well, I knew this was a Bree Roger infused episode. So I assumed it was going to be from the 70s. But then I further assumed it was going to be part of the Scottish games that they're going to in the 70s. I wasn't positive they were going to light it on fire. But when you see something flammable and made of sticks, that's really the only thing you do with it, unless you're making it a topiary. And I figured it was not a topiary.
The thing that I first thought of, and again, not the first watch, but when I sat down second watch to take to do my notes, was that the first thing that came into my head was Trojan horse.
Trojan stag?
Yeah. So I know it's not completely analogous, but if I stretch it just a little bit. So here's Bree getting it. And again, I'm not skipping. I'm just talking about, I'm bringing stuff a little bit forward to make the point about the Trojan stag. Here's Bree getting it on with Roger, spending time with him or getting in with Roger, loving him, being physical with him. Note, this is definitely a Roger view, not mine, what I'm about to say. He does want to be with her, but only totally. So when she rejects him, again, this is what he sees as rejection. He feels betrayed. So she came into this event, into this weekend, a bit of a Trojan horse, hiding intent, or at least not revealing intent, until she was already in his heart and mind.
She entered the weekend as a false bride.
Yes, and hence the Trojan horse.
Trojan stag.
Or Trojan stag. Okay, so I tried. It doesn't fit on all the levels, but it's a tiny, tiny, tiny bit okay. Totally, as Summer said, totally Brianna is the false bride. It's like, I thought their scenes, general chit-chat, I thought their scenes were done really well. As a reader, I squeed. I had all the tear pricks, of course. So now let's get to the top of the episode. Roger is leaving the manse, or rather handing over care of the manse, bought it, it's now theirs, to Fiona and Ernie. Now, I don't think that we ever hear his name in the show.
They do. They call him Ernie. She calls him Ernie.
Okay, so yeah, that's her husband. Loved it.
They weren't married yet.
Sorry, her fiance. I wonder how many times they had to do the scene with the opening the champagne. It only takes once to get it to pop, but that kind of stuff can go wrong.
I don't know. I'm just not going to miss the 70s, for Roger at least. Some of those button-up shirts they have in are not kind. I just think I can't wait to see him in things that are not from the 1970s. I think he's going to look real good.
Then we learn that Roger is going to play at a Scottish festival in America. And then along the same, it's the person who's saying all of this, of course, is Fiona. She says she's telling Ernie he's courting a lass who is studying engineering at MIT. So that's how they work in her change of major. That's how they tell us about it. Also, we find out that Bree had visited him at Oxford that summer. And remember, this is 1970. And then, or at least the summer before, and then they had also spent Christmas together, and he says the word again. So this is now at least a year after Claire is gone. Yeah.
Right. So it's been a year.
So they write and chat. He says they write letters and sometimes chat on the phone. But it seems like, you know, it's not uncommitted, but Fiona can tell that he's like, he's got a thing. He's got it for her. And she says, you need to tell her that you love her. So basically this episode, at least the Roger B bit, is Fiona's fault because she told him to do it.
I mean, don't blame Fee.
Oh, I did. Totally. I already did. And then we go back to the 18th century and we're at River Wren. Jamie and Claire must leave.
Like this was the day after.
I know.
It was one day later and they were like,
peace out.
I'm out. They're all that was too much. We're not doing that again.
And Jocasta, okay, when I say this, I don't mean this on every single level, but what I wrote was Jocasta really doesn't get it. She gets it as far as she knows they're leaving. She accepts that they are leaving. She's not happy about it, but she knows they're physically getting ready to go. She even helps them. She gives them money. She like has her slaves help pack up all their wagon crap. So she's giving them a great send off as far as stuff. And her door is always open, but she doesn't get truly deeply in her heart. She does not get the why.
No. And she says, what did she say to him? She says, I thought in time you would accept the ways that are the ways of things that are different and come to love River on the way that I do. And I'm like, you're saying that I thought in time we would forget all of our beliefs and just accept that this is the way that it is. No, you clearly don't know Claire.
Exactly.
And you've misjudged your nephew.
There's more to that. Yeah. Something that, okay, it's not that we don't like hearing from you. We want to hear from you guys in all the ways. It's that because we are an audio medium, we like to share your voices. So when we ask for feedback, the ones that we share are the audio feedback, the voice feedback. However, as I was going through emails, I saw one from last week that was about 402. And I'm not sharing the entire email because, again, it was shared with us, but it wasn't a voice feedback. But one of the lines caught me and I was like, oh, I've never heard it put so succinctly. I thought this is perfect. So Megan P. wrote this, the most perfect description of Jocasta. Quote, Jocasta is column made over, unquote. And I thought, how perfect is that? Because as a few, I think Summer said it.
I haven't seen her legs yet.
Oh, Lord of mercy. Summer. So what is their plan now? The plan is still to send Ian home to Scotland. And they'll remain here in the colonies. And they'll travel west. Maybe settle in a place called, is it Williams or Woolhams? I could not understand.
I thought it was Woolhams.
Okay.
Woolhams.
That's what I thought. Woolhams Creek. And he'll maybe set up as a printer and she'll set up as a healer. And Jocasta scoffs and he tries, this is Jamie and Jocasta scene, and he tries to give her back the money and she's like, no. And this I thought was very smart of her because he would not allow this to, obviously, they're on their way out. He's not staying. He's not going to take any guilt trips over this. But he is smart because I think she's right here. Quote, do not let your pride stand in the way of your family's security, unquote, about taking the small sum of money from her. Also, Ulysses, as I said, sets them up for the journey, packs the wagon with food and supplies. And also here, like out of the blue, she goes, Jocasta says, here, take these candlesticks. They were your mother's. Her name was Ellen. This was my first tear prick. Maria, dang it, the slight catch in her voice when she is saying that these are your mother's. And the music here is low and beautiful and, of course, sad. Just gracious. Just, okay, I told Summer already, so she doesn't know where it's going to be or when. It's the same thing. This is going to be a music chat heavy episode. You're welcome. Young Ian stands up and tells Jamie that he's a man. He insists on staying. He's like, look, I'm not going back home. I've done this and this and I've done this and I can speak for myself now. And whether or not Jamie actually agrees with him or agrees with them out of guilt, either, maybe both. I think it's a little bit of both. But for someone who is adamant about him returning, quote, "You will return home," he says, Jamie rolls over pretty quickly. And I don't think that is very Jamie-like. That's all. I was surprised with how it just took one reminder, a strong reminder. But like Jamie could have said something like, oh, well, you know, grumble, grumble, we'll talk about it. Something like that. And then could have had his mind changed over a day or two. But I was like, okay, they did that quickly. In the book, if I'm not mistaken, again, I don't care that they changed it. It's just sometimes certain changes can be less believable. That's all I'll say. In the book, Ian stayed. The only way Ian stayed with them in the beginning was through deception. Right, Sam?
In the book, yes.
He said something about how he was going to be on a boat and the ship had actually already sailed. It's just interesting that he like by the skin of his teeth gets to stay in the book. And here it's him. I mean, yeah, he's using his agency to do so. I just think it's a little easy for him to convince his uncle who 2 minutes before had said, you are going home. But obviously we want and need Ian. So it all ends well. And then we have Claire and Jocasta, as Summer was talking about. She says, what happened last night? I wish it had been different. Jocasta doesn't quite display the formula for giving critique known as kiss, kick, kiss. She kisses, meaning she finds common ground, their common wish that the night before had been different, and then kisses again. She says, I admire a woman who knows her mind. And then she kicks, quote, you're doing him a great disservice, you Ken. You're the reason he wouldn't accept my offer. If you truly love Jamie as much as you say you do, you'd want him to be the man he was born to be, to have the things he lost in Scotland, the chance to be a laird, unquote. Yeah, again, have we said Jocasta doesn't get it? And this, and Jocasta, of all people, she knew, she's a very strong woman, and she is a Mackenzie, and as she said in episode 2, I think it was last episode, Hector, even though he was the laird or the master of the plantation, master of the house, she says that he never made a decision without consulting her. And okay, so she knew that her opinion was valued, but she also knew her place, maybe not her place with her husband, but her place in this society. So she knew that even if he completely had her make all the decisions, it had to come from him because he was the man of the house. So he was the master. So he was in charge. And so maybe because of that, because of how strong she knew her role, at least her own role was, she knows the strength. She knows the possibility of influence a wife has over her husband, especially if he is besotted with her like Jamie is with Claire. And she uses that to kick Claire in this kiss, kick, kiss, which she didn't do, actually. She went kiss, kiss, kick. So as much as we may pick on Claire for some of the decisions she makes, she's already dealing with a lot. Let's not add to the poo. She's already felt guilt at coming back and expecting him to uproot his life. She already feels bad for all that her returning has done to him and his family. She's been dealing with it throughout since season 3. Though she's firm in her convictions, for example, her stance of not accepting slavery at all, she does not need someone who is kin to use her relationship with family to try to manipulate her. She knows their decision is the best for the both of them, and she absolutely feels bad that Jamie has suffered so much and has had to leave his homeland, lost his home, is no longer the laird he was, not actually born to be because, of course, he had an older brother, but he is king of men, and she knows this, and she carries that weight with her, even though it's not her fault. Jocasta ends the discussion with, quote, you're going to squander his talents behind a printer's counter, unquote.
She's so mean, dude. She's so like disdainful of him having a job. How dare he have a job? That's so beneath him. He's never going to be a laird. They will never be lairds in the colonies the way they were lairds back in Scotland. He could create his own new existence, you know, with his own new hierarchy of whatever's, but it's never going to be exactly the same because the people aren't the same.
This scene with Jocasta and Claire, there was so much Mackenzie. All the Mackenzie came out. Oh my gosh. So for Jocasta to say all of this, Claire, of course, gets her back up. She knows they must not stay. She knows they cannot stay. But that little twinge of guilt that Jocasta stokes, that's ugly. And the rest of the episode, notice that when Jamie and Claire are alone together, this whole thing plays. She talks about what he has. Don't do this because, you know, don't think you don't have things to give me. Don't think I don't love you. Don't think you don't have to give me all the stuff that you think you need to give me. And then him, she feels bad because she doesn't want him to feel guilty. And he feels guilty because he can't give her. So this whole thing, and Jocasta did not start it, but she stoked it. Well, Claire is classy as always. And thanks, Jocasta, for her hospitality as she leaves. And then outside, all the Clarence. Yes, that made me tear prick too when we got our Clarence. And then we get to see John Quincy Myers again. It's a little mini reunion.
Yeah, it's all of that. Jocasta, I don't want to see you go, but I'm going to make sure that you have all the things you need.
Well, because she still loves
like
them.
I said, she still wants I know, them. But she's like, she doesn't want them to go, but she's going to set him up with a guide. She's going to make sure that they have all the things they need. I'm just the denial of still trying to get them to stay, even though.
Oh, completely. Like she was. My guess is like she had the stuff ready for the wagon. Probably the wagon was like already ready. And she was just using this because she's a Mackenzie. She's a fox. She's clever. She's a manipulator. And it usually works for her. So it's worth it. I mean, from her point of view, it is worth it. One more time. Let's give it one more college try. Myers is going to guide them into the Blue Ridge. And it's sweet and sad when Ulysses tells Jocasta, quote, your nephew bids you farewell, mistress, unquote. And she doesn't wave. She doesn't like really move her face much at all. And then we're back to, or not back to, we're in Boston, 20th century, like 1970, right? 70?
Yeah, 70s.
Interesting music as Roger is walking in the airport to meet Bree.
And I was reminded of the days before 9/11, when we could all go down to the gates and pick up our loved ones.
I know. The music is upbeat. It starts minor, but then there's a stringed instrument comes in, and we get the major third. So it makes it kind of settles more well with us. And then when does that major third come to make it a major chord? When we see Bree's smiling face. And yep, got another tear prick. Okay, this is where the music stuff starts to get. There's only one more music comment right here, but later on, there's like an entire scene I break down music, an entire freaking scene, because it's just magical. Okay, so as I just said, when Roger comes down the gateway, right? When Roger comes down gangway and she meets him and the camera is on him and then it goes to her, when we see her smiling face, that's when this music rises. And then as she smiles, the major third is played. And when we see that, OMG, if you listen very closely, there's a clarinet in this little melody there. And I couldn't take it anymore because we know what that is. So just as Roger comes up to her, he puts his bag down. Then that's where you'll hear the clarinet. So I went back to make sure like where it happened, when it happened. So Bree's theme or their theme must have a clarinet in it. Or at least Bree's. If we get we don't know if we're going to get a Bree theme, Roger theme, or Roger and Bree. I'm pretty sure we'll get a Roger and Bree theme. I don't know about individual, but it's probably the Roger and Bree because they're together here. They're not alone. But whatever their theme is, some measure of it has a clarinet involved. So they're a little awkward at first, but they kind of loosen up and they have quite the car ride to North Carolina. I thought it was a nice change rather than having it at Boston, because then later on when they're going back and forth between the 18th and 20th centuries, they're not on the same, likely not on the same exact grounds, but it's our people, our favorite people. Just in different centuries, but in the same place, basically. I love the music that's playing when they're going down the road. It's I looked it up, which I never do typically. It is Testify by Ron Wood from 1967. And I love the fact that every scene, I love the cars and the fact that every scene with driving with the two of them, this sequence, I guess, has nothing but period cars on the road. Like, and the music, of course.
Even the film quality had the look of like 70s TV movies.
I know. It was amazing.
And it was gritty and...
It was amazing. And Roger is obsessed with Dairy Queen. And how sweet is that? They play the minister's cat, which is straight from the book. Most of the answers are most of that game is straight from the book. And then after she kisses him and almost kills them both, the music starts up again. Again, I'm thinking it's their theme. It starts minor with a hint of major. And the theme or this music stops once we get back to the 18th century, which is pretty soon. John Quincy Myers is doing his job. He mentions, we get a mention of the Tuscarora, which is a nod to the book.
But did you like the transition from the 70s to the 1700s? Where they're just like, it looked like almost the exact same curve in the road, but it went from being a paved area to just...
Yeah.
I thought that was really well done. I enjoyed that.
John Quincy Myers mentions the Tuscarora. He says there are not a lot of them around anymore. And so that was a nice nod to the book. As, of course, we found out, the Cherokee will be the ones, the major players, before we get to the Mohawk this season. So, and John Quincy Myers just happens to speak Cherokee, of course. We learn from, I mean, I think Ian tells us, but we learned that Cherokee John says it, right? Cherokee women get to choose whom they marry and whom they bed with.
Yeah, but how awkward was that convo? That Ian's just like, John Quincy Myers just met these dudes, right? And this would be like if I went someplace with you and we were going to hang out with some of your work friends. And first thing that you say when we all get in the car together is, so Summer likes to have sex with this type of people.
I would never.
You wouldn't because you're not Ian. But my point is that's what went down on that wagon.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
And John Quincy Myers was completely unflappable. He just rolled with it.
He did, but he did seem a little bit like, okay.
He's like, oh, so we're doing that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So the music here as they make their way through the backcountry is yearning, beautiful, and sad. And it definitely has a country feel to it. Definitely has a country feel to it. Now, I'm curious how much, I mean, I'm interested in your opinion, Summer, and if you actually know it, like know the fact of it, obviously, please share. How much of the scenery, or at least the 20th century scenery from the Highland Fest, and not the Highland Fest, but when they show mountains and eagles and that kind of stuff, how much of that is from the U.S.? Is none of it from the U.S.?
I don't know for certain because I have not asked anybody on set. However, a lot of the imagery that they used was very reminiscent of places I've seen in North Carolina. So they probably did just like shots that didn't require actors in them. I bet they did some scenery shots in North Carolina to filter through and intersperse with the live shots they did in Scotland.
John Quincy Myers and Ian will be leaving Jamie and Claire to go to a trading post. And Ian pretty much just announces this. And Jamie and Claire are like, okay then. So Ian and John Quincy Myers will take the wagon. And this gets our protagonists alone, so things can happen to them. Myers can be a bit evasive. Claire asks him, for example, how long he's lived in the mountains. His reply, these mountains are old friends to me. So, okay, is that 5 years old friends, 10 years, 20 years old friends? Like, give us a ballpark.
Depends on when he was transported.
I thought you were going to say depends on when he transitioned. I was going to be like, what?
No.
No. That's a different Outlander story. So he
don't have those kind of drugs back then.
That's true. He promises to keep Ian safe. And they'll meet up with him at Willems Creek.
I cannot imagine meeting anybody hitchhiking. Because that's basically what they did, right? They hitchhiked with him. So they're like, oh, well, yeah, I guess we'll all go together. We'll carpool. So we're going to do an Uber carpool with strangers. And we're all going together. And then as we're all talking, we'll just say this time it's you, Ginger. Ginger just says, hey, So I know we were all going to this one place, but this dude's getting out two stops early and I'm just going to go with him. Is that cool? I'll catch you guys later. No, they don't know him. He's magic, that John Quincy Myers.
Maybe he does have a third ball.
Maybe. And he rubs it for luck.
Gosh, stop. So just as I mentioned, Claire carries guilt about Jamie, so does he carry guilt about her. As they're sitting at the fire, he says, quote, "Are you sure you wouldn't rather go to a place you're more familiar with, like Boston, some place we could start anew?" Unquote. Now, maybe not exactly guilt that he has. And yes, of course he feels for her and he wants her to be happy and comfortable. But he, too, is conscious of what she's given up. It's not a competition, but it is pretty even, isn't it? I mean, he's lost his home, livelihood, country, all of his children and his wife. But he gets her back. She's lost her home, their only living child, to go back to him. They are rich as they have each other, but each carries the guilt of what the other has given up to be with them.
Does anybody else think that Ian only wants to go meet the Indians because he's hoping to get a little something, something?
He's hoping to be chosen.
He's hoping to get a little something, something.
Yeah, because the women choose and he wants to be chosen. Claire says that, well, Boston actually wouldn't be starting anew. Like, I've had a life there already. But she also reminds him of the danger there. That's where the revolution will start. Quote, "I want us to make a home together in a place that's ours." Unquote. And of course, their love theme starts up here. Tearbrick again. Damn it. The next day, onward, we see different shots of nature. There are turkeys. There's something else. There's something else. And I thought, oh, okay, that's cool. They chat about the choice that women have in her time. He asks, like, oh, so Bree gets to choose what she wants to do? And Claire says that when she left, Bree didn't exactly know what she wanted to do career-wise, and she's worried Bree wouldn't find something that she was passionate about. She says also that Frank and Bree spent more time together. Now, from this, I take it that they spent more time together than she and Bree did, because, of course, all the medical school, and then, of course, working as a doctor. Then she says that since she believes that is why Brianna chose history to major in to start with, to please him. And right when she says this, clarinet. I'm just telling you, it's there for anyone to listen to. Okay, there's a storm coming. And then they're having a conversation about, oh, well, once we get into town, we'll find a place to stay. And she goes, oh, maybe perhaps a quaint brothel. That was a good line, Claire. They stop to look after the horses. Something's going on with one of the horses' shoes. Jamie's fixing it or doing something with it. And out comes the Claire guilt. She says, I don't want you making decisions because you think it's what I want. She mentions the importance of something that will become really well known in the States, this phrase, pursuit of happiness. Jamie says he wouldn't mind being an outlaw if it weren't for her. But for her, Ian, Fergus, and Marsali, quote, I would lay the world at your feet, Claire, but I have nothing to give you, unquote. Enter Thunder. Clarence freaks out and runs off, and she's like, I'll go get him. And have I mentioned yet my love for Clarence? And then, of course, Claire gets lost or runs out after him.
How dumb is that? Like, legitimately, you're in the middle of unfamiliar territory. You only know one other person in the entire area, and you're going to run away from them? I would have been like, first of all, Jamie was right. Clarence came back. And why would you not wait and go together? Because if you don't find the donkey, at least then you still have each other. Good Lord, Claire.
Oh, so at the Scottish Festival in the 20th century, there we see the scene opens with Highland dancing. Our friend Casey will love this. The announcer sounded like, at first, because I had to readjust my ears to the sound, it sounded like he was announcing an auction. I can't do it, but that kind of thing. It didn't sound like it, but it kind of did. Roger and Bree arrive. How do we know it's Grandfather Mountain? Well, we think it is because it says in the sign behind them, America's oldest Scottish festival. So I believe it's the Grandfather Mountain Highland Games now, at least what it's called now.
Well, that's the one in North Carolina, and they were going to North Carolina, so it tracks.
Yeah. So I'm curious if the burning of a stag was traditional, and I guess, and so I made the notes before Summer shared what she looked up. But you didn't find it was exactly traditional as far as a Scottish festival,
I couldn't
right?
find it linked. Like I Googled as much as I could and I could not find it linked to a Highland festival, but it was linked to Hogmanay.
That's right. And then there's a history lesson for Bree. Roger tells her that the Scots settled in North Carolina in the 18th century. And finally, we know the source of the sketched image of Bree that we see in the opening credits. And we know that there's a Roger next to it.
Did you listen to the announcer?
No, what was it?
In the background, over the bullhorn, just like randomly spouting off things about things. He was like, Scottish shortbread, now available in the marketplace.
I probably heard it, but dismissed it.
Because, for instance, you expect them to be like, caber toss in 20 minutes over at the whatever.
Whiskey
I'm
tasting.
Fairly, right. Place, yeah. I'm fairly certain. I'm fairly
Don't shark,
certain.
Please.
No sharding. I'm fairly certain that shot. God bless America. I'm fairly certain that shortbread was always available. I don't think they were baking it on site. So for them being like, got a shortbread funny. Now available at the market, wherever they were. But that one stuck out to me. And then that I couldn't understand the rest of them, but that one it definitely was one that caught my attention.
So as I said, we know the source of this sketch of Roger and Bree, or excuse me, we didn't know before. We know the source of a sketch of Brianna. It's actually a sketch of both of them. And in the opening credit, we only see her, which means either the paper was torn or folded. We don't know yet. We don't know yet. We'll find out. Do we know that Brianna is artistic?
I thought you said autistic. I was like, I don't think she's autistic at all.
Okay. Look, we're making up our own story. John Quincy Myers is transitioning. That's why he has a third ball. And Brianna is autistic. What? I could have sworn we knew something. I mean, this could be like the books just coming into my head. But I could have sworn we had some evidence of her being artistic. I mean, obviously, she studies engineering, she has to do a lot of physics and, you know, make a lot of drawings. Doesn't mean you're a good artist, but do we know yet that Brianna is an artist?
I don't recall any, except for, was it the Christmas? Wasn't there a Christmas ornament or a Christmas thing or other that she'd done? Wasn't she making Christmas ornaments one episode last year?
Maybe. Oh, before her mom left?
Last season.
Maybe. I mean, I think she did, but I don't know if she like drew anything.
Oh, I don't. I couldn't go that far.
So it's kind of important that she does. Again, unless they decide to.
We'll have to wait and see.
Oh, Lord. Actually, now that I say it, the sketch of the two of them could actually be doing double duty. But that's all I'll say. Okay. So as they sit down to get their sketch, she says, I'm a Fraser, but my boyfriend's a Mackenzie. So let's get two Mackenzie tartans. This totally, again, watching it for the second time, not the first time, it like lays on the layers of what Roger ends up feeling or reacting to. So not only does she want a sketch, I mean, that's great. That's not, you know, that's not too much or that's not so much. But and then she says publicly that he's her boyfriend. And then she says publicly, oh, but he's a Mackenzie. So let's both wear these. Oh, my goodness. So... I mean, poor Roger. It just feeds into his feelings that we hear about later on. And then they dance. It's kind of like a hoedown. It's very sweet together. It's very short. It's not very long. This is not the scene I'm breaking down. That's later. But this is the beginning of kind of the nitty gritty music stuff. Okay. So as they're dancing, they're twirling, right? And then the video, it goes to slow-mo. As they do the slow-mo twirl, 100%, we've all heard it. That has to be their theme.
Okay. Before we talk about your theme, because you know I don't care.
it's not my theme. It's their theme.
I still don't care. So they get into the whole Kaylee thing. And they're like, Kaylee dancing, that sounds like fun. And the lady, the only direction they're given is spin for 16 beats. And that didn't nearly cover the amount of dancing they were required to do. They did way more than spin for 16 beats. So I don't think that they were given remotely enough direction to have been able to complete the Kaylee dance. Go ahead. Tell me things I don't care about.
I was trying to yawn. Don't make me laugh in the middle of a yawn. Okay. So I will have to record, not right now, but I will have to go back and watch it again. I'll like fast forward to their, because it's only their scenes. I want to get, I want to actually record the music from the playing. So I'd like use my my external recorder to record the show sound. That's the only way I can. Well, I guess I could compare it if I transcribe it. I could do that, but that's work. I'd rather just listen. Anyway, I'm going to have to isolate these and then put them, play them after each other and not just, you know. Anyway, first step is getting timestamps, but I will have to isolate them. Okay. But I am 99.9% positive by this point that we have their theme. Okay. So it's at 27 minutes and 15 seconds. Now, I don't know the exact notes. I did not have perfect pitch, but I matched pitch with the music and then found the tonic. So I was able to do like solfege, right? So it's 5-6-1, da da da. That is the whenever you hear that, that is their theme. I mean, it's not just that only, but that was the part that I listened for. Then I'm like, ah, okay, that's their theme. It's like da 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 da. It always goes down back to the tonic. So gorgeous. This is where I started to cry. Not like bawling, but not just tear prick. It was like it was coming out. So I didn't hear any clarinets. Maybe there's a difference between their theme and her own theme. Again, if she has a theme. But later on, I do hear a clarinet elsewhere, which I'll get into later. So that is 100% their theme right there. Back to the 18th century. Clarence returns to Jamie, as we knew, alone.
I feel bad for Jamie. It's hard being red all the time.
Hard being, I thought you said hard being red all the time.
No, it's hard being right all the time and never being listened to.
Going on. Clarence returns. You know, when I was writing Clarence, I kept writing Claire, C-L-A-I-R-E-N-C-E.
Not surprised.
I was like, dang, that's funny. I don't want to ship those two. That's called bestiality. Clarence returns and alone. Claire is still out.
Then they go back to her going, Clarence, Clarence. And then all of a sudden, where am I? Duh, bitch. Duh. That's why you didn't chase after the donkey. That's why you should have stayed with Jamie.
Exactly.
You don't know where you are.
Yes. Right as she, she's always lost, but right as she kind of stops and is looking around and lightning and thunder and everything, lightning hits a tree, exactly from the book, freaks the horse out. In the book, that specific horse's name was Jasper, and he ends up dead. So I don't think they're going to kill him off here because he ended up with Jamie the next morning. But I think it was Jasper. Anyway, the horse freaks out and like runs off a ledge or under. I don't know. But she ends up falling to and then passing out or her passing out. Maybe not even. Whatever. It's somewhat similar. So here she does is she's knocked unconscious. Okay. 20th century. Okay. Oh, la, 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 la. Roger plays the same short passage that we hear at the very beginning of the episode when he's in the manse. It's very short. And then he says, it's for something a little different. I think he says that. And he sings his own song. And this song is called The False Bride. Did you look it up some? Okay. Thanks for letting me do my job. So this song is called The False Bride. This is, of course, where the title comes from. I will include a link in the show notes for the most thorough discussion of this song or text and its history I think you will ever find. It is very long. Folklorist Jürgen Kloss has done amazingly, amazingly. And it's his website is justanothertune.com, and I will include it. So if you go there, you'll see the six stanzas, I believe, the six verses. I checked it according to what Roger sang, and he sang verses 1, 3, and 4. And it was during verse 4 on the line, quote, how many ships sail in the forest, unquote, that Brianna takes out the sketch of them, and we finally get a look at it. So the article by Jürgen Kloss, at the beginning of it, mind, gives these six verses. Obviously, they couldn't spend 10 minutes on this song alone, although I do wonder if he sang it all or if it was always planned to just do verses 1, 3, 4 or whatever. So here are the lyrics to the here's what he sings, in case you couldn't understand. I once loved a lass, and I loved her sae weel. I hated all others that spoke of her ill, but knew she's rewarded me weel for my love, for she's gone to be wed till nither. When I saw my love sit down to dine, I sat down beside her and poured out the wine. And I drank to the last that should have been mine. And now she is wed till anither. The men of yon forest, they ask it of me, how many strawberries grew in the salt sea? But I ask it them back with a tear in my ee, how many ships sail in the forest? So you will find the crazy history going back to the 17th century of some version of that song. It's got quite a history. So definitely urge you to go look at that. It is long and rich, and definitely you can tell either a musicologist or a folklorist. He is a folklorist. He did a really amazing job. And then the next scene, we're in front of the sign that says North Carolina Highlander Lodge, established 1944, number 10. And they walk back to the lodges. He kisses her. It's about time, dude. And then he says goodnight. She bought him something, though. She bought him a book about Scottish settlers in colonial America and his favorite mountain moonshine. So as we get into probably the climax of the entire episode, because let's face it, this was their episode. What did you think about this scene in the lot, the one we're about to get into?
I thought that was the towel scene, only instead it was a combination of the towel slash after church scene, only instead of the towel dropping on the floor, it was the I threw my shirt on top of the stag head combo with a bunch of other stuff.
So inside, they enjoy a dram. And he doesn't like the stag's head. As he stands up to talk to the stag head, her shirt plops on top of it. Now, this is where the music starts. Like, because up until now, once they're inside, there's no background music. His reaction to the shirt landing and then turning around and seeing her is hysterical. So she's now shirtless, not braless. And of course, he kisses her. And so their kissing ends up, this is where the fall takes place, as Summer said. It's rather than in the hallway of the manse. I'm so glad they kept some version of this. Here, the music isn't yet the same as the 5-6-1, the da-da-da. It's not quite, but it's getting towards there. Okay, he stops, and he wants to give her a gift first. Quote, I want this to be perfect. And then she says, it is perfect. Here the music sounds and feels somewhat questioning. It's gone from gorgeous under their makeout to hesitating when he stops them. Uh-oh. The first signal that it might not be going so well, she's covering herself up. He retrieves her shirt, puts it on her, and that's kind of sweet. Right around this, we hear the plucking or finger picking of what I'm guessing is a guitar. So we get a little Roger in the music. The music under the scene where he offers her the silver bracelet is low and slow but steady as the guitar finger picking. The bracelet says, je t'aime, un peu, beaucoup, passionnément, pas du tout. This must be Roger. So whether it's Roger's portion of their theme or just music for Roger, I don't know. But it makes me wonder if this is now their theme. So like, am I getting it wrong before? It's very sweet music while she looks at the bracelet with on the base of it, the floor of it is a guitar. And then it's when I knew it was their theme. Because just as she looks at it and we hear the guitar, you hear the 5-6-1 on the guitar. The guitar is now playing the da-da-da. As he says, quote, the whole weekend's been perfect. The strings come up, and then the strings play the 5-6-1 right under when he says, I love you. So that's it. That is, to me, proof positive. We have their theme, and the guitar is Roger. When he asks her to marry him, the music doesn't do 5-6-1. It doesn't resolve. There is no one. There is no tonic. She says, quote, Roger, this is very fast, unquote. And as he goes on talking, the music falls on 3-5-6-3. So instead of da-da-da, it goes da-da-da. So see, it doesn't go down home to the tonic anymore. The one comes again when he says, I want to have a home with you. Now, how perfect is this? Tonally, one, the tonic is the musical home of the key, right when he says, I want to have a home with you. She stops him from going any further, and the music stops on 3. So it's not, she stops him and says, I'm not ready. This music ends on three, so it does not complete. It's heartbreaking watching Roger get his slammed. She tries to kiss him, and they kept it. So they kept the slut shaming. Now, I am not saying that she's a slut, and I don't know that Roger is exactly saying that, but you could take it, at least nowadays, you could take it as such. As a book reader mind, this is pretty strongly from the book. And then, of course, she slaps him and he says, if you don't care enough to marry me, then I don't care enough to have you in my bed. And then, what do you mean by making such an offer? A nice Catholic girl? I thought you were a virgin. She replies, I am. What the hell does that have to do with it? And don't tell me you haven't had girls. They definitely kept our Roger. He says he's old-fashioned. And his point? He did not love them. He says, I love you, damn it, but you don't love me. And she's like, I didn't say that. And then he says, you didn't have to. And Roger pieces out. I will say the first time I watched it, I really enjoyed it. Maybe got a tear prick. When I slowed it down and listened for the music cues, I straight up like had tears all over. That's the difference to me and the magic that a composer can make to a piece. So that was kind of the definitely Roger and Brie climax of the episode.
I thought it was weird of Brianna to try to keep making out with him after she said no, because I don't think anyone thinks a no to a marriage proposal is sexy talk.
I think she felt bad, but I think it was a little awkward or a lot awkward for her to still want to make out with him, whatever, after she told him no.
And then she also commented about, oh, it's very fast. They've been like interacting with each other for like 2 years now. So I don't know that it's that fast. I think maybe his jump into all the things. I think if he just stopped it with, you know, marry me, we can go as long, we can wait as long as you want. I think he might have had a chance at it if he'd stopped there. But I think the fact that he already had them in a house, he had them with four babies, and he had the whole thing planned out, and he has no idea that she doesn't even know if she believes in marriage at this point.
Well, I thought it was interesting that he went quite far, but I think what would have been a really nice cap on this weekend together is give the gift. You had planned that. That was a beautiful gift. I think she liked it. Give the gift and tell her you love her. Because that's all Fiona was saying. Fiona wasn't saying, go tell her you want to have 10 babies. You don't need to. And not that Fiona like rocks his world or makes a decision for him. No. But that's all she meant is like, don't let this slip away. You know, don't waste this opportunity, etc. Go get her. But yeah, if he had done the gift plus an I love you, because from what I understand, they hadn't said it yet. And that's a huge step. But yeah, if he had, or like you said, if he had done everything, the I love you, the gift, and the proposal, but stopped at the proposal. And then if she said, you know, like was a little bit wonky about it or unsure, then if he had said, look, we can be engaged for as long as you want. I just want to know that you will, I just want to spend the rest of my life with you. But I'm happy to, I'm not in a rush for this. You know what I mean? So I can definitely see that too.
And then with his whole, yeah, I've slept with other people, but you can't sleep with other people. And you can't, I slept with other people before I got married, but you can't sleep with other people before I get married. And I won't sleep with you unless you promise to marry me.
I thought about that. I think it's possible, I mean, only person who knows this truly will be Diana. It's possible that we are looking at this only from one direction, and that is from, well, not only from our current time, but it is easy to see or to think that he is being hypocritical, right? Because he's saying, I won't sleep with you because I love you, but I won't sleep with you without knowing that I'm going to marry you. You know, we don't have to wait till we're married, but I love you. I want this commitment before I sleep with you. Whereas he obviously didn't want that commitment from his previous lovers.
Right. But then she was dumb, because if she'd really thought about it, all he really wanted was a, yes, I agree to someday in the future marry you. And she could have totally gotten her rocks off.
She could have. But what I'm trying to say is, I think it's easy to look at this from a he's being hypocritical point of view. I believe, and Diana can tell me I'm wrong, but I believe if she had been with another person or persons, people, even if she weren't, I don't think the fact that she was a virgin was the reason he wanted to be with her. He loved her for her. He probably liked that she was a virgin.
No, but he brought it up.
Yeah, of course he brought it up. He brought it up because here she was throwing herself at him. And he's like, wait a second, that's not what I thought you were. Not because he necessarily judged it, although maybe he did or does. But I think it's just like, oh, I didn't know you had this kind of experience. You're shocking. You're surprising me. Not that she couldn't or shouldn't, but it was not something she had done before. And probably not something he associated with a virgin. So that's definitely a stereotype. But I'm curious, if she wasn't a virgin or hadn't been a virgin and did the same thing, and he knew she if she wasn't one and he knew she wasn't one, if there would have been an issue. Because if he truly felt the same way he feels right now, her being a virgin or not being a virgin wasn't the issue. It was the fact that he didn't want to be with her unless he could be with her in all ways.
Well, I think the fact that he brought it up made it an issue. I think if he hadn't brought it up, it would not have been an issue. And you could have just blanket stated, she's different and I don't want to do what I've done with other people.
That's
true. And I want what we have to be special and unmarred by anything. But he brought it up. And by bringing it up and naming it, you made it a thing.
Exactly. But I think it's possible that he brought it up because he was surprised that the actions she was taking, trying to, in her whatever way, her attempt at seducing him or her attempt of, you know, wanting to be with him right then, in his experience, or at least in his experience of her or with her, he knows she's a virgin. And then she's acting like this. Now, I'm not saying a virgin shouldn't act like this or doesn't have a right to act like this. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, I think, and this is, you could also say that this is stereotypical, if he definitely has a stereotype of how a virgin should act, right? And that is not what she was not following that. But what I'm saying is it's possible. He definitely brought it up. I'm just offering another possibility. Maybe he said that because he was shocked at not because she was doing what she was doing or acting the way she was acting, but because she was doing so and refused to be with him fully. That's all. But yeah, either way, he brought it up. And then we go back to the 18th century. Claire's waking up in the rain. She goes to the hollow of a tree or this like little, not cave, but this little, I guess hollow is the best word, to get out of the elements. She takes off her shoes, finds a skull, and notices that the person whose skull this was had a lot of head trauma.
Well, leave it to Claire to find a hiding place or a shelter, if you will, with a skull in it. And not immediately think, I need to find someplace else to go hide.
Like right. Anyone else.
Because if I was hiding someplace and I found a skull, I might think, what else is in here? What put the skull here? And are they coming back? Maybe this is not the best place to hide.
We hear the wolves in the background. Claire never has luck with wolves, by the way. At least in the book, she never has luck with the wolves. And then she finds an opal.
I always forget about the wolves when she's immediately not into Rollo.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
I'm always like, but he's so cute, Rollo. And then I always forget that, you know, she almost died by wolf in book one.
I couldn't tell that there were. I looked at it. I tried to pause it. I couldn't tell if there were any glyphs on the opal. Could you?
No. I could barely tell how it was faceted. There it was.
I know. Looked very raw.
Yeah.
She sees the ghost of a rando indigenous man.
The idea that a torch would stay lit in that weather was all of the that she should have needed to know that that was not Jamie. And in fact, it was some sort of supernatural visitor.
Oh, that's funny. That's true. Because she was all, Jamie, well done. So he's wearing the opal. If I'm not mistaken, he's wearing the big chunk of opal around his neck.
Yes.
And as he turns and when he finally walks away, it's kind of gross. I'm not going to lie. It was kind of gross. So you see that he was partially scalped, or at least part of his scalp was gone.
Well, he was when he turned. So before when he faced her, he still had the scalp. And when he turned, he was without scalp. So the hair was all gone at that point when he turned.
The hair. Yeah. But his ears were still connected.
He did not have a full head of hair. He had ceremonially shaved hairstyle. So it was just a patch on the very, very tip top. You can scalp somebody and leave their ears intact. He just, and usually when they did, from what I understand, when they did scalp people, they didn't take the whole scalp. They didn't take you from the front of your head all the way to the back and leave no hair left. Usually, I believe it was just part of the scalp. And I am not a scalping expert. If there are any out there who would like to school us on the nature of scalping, you know our email address. But from what I understand, it was in all of the movies I watched in the past, and Last of the Mohicans, one of my favorites, when scalpings were done, it was just like the top of the scalp. But that could also just be because movie magic, it's easier to just do that. But I don't know. Again, not an expert.
Back in the 20th century, North Carolina Scottish Festival, it is time for the calling of the clans, where Roger had wanted Bree to stand next to him. He's sitting in the stands, and it was very sweet how she joins him. They're both upset at the way things ended. They hold hands, but then he's like, nope, can't do it. He can't pretend. He says again, I'll have you all or not at all. She tries to return the bracelet, and he says, no, keep it. It's a gift. They call for the Mackenzies, and he gets ready to go down. He calls for the Mackenzies. They end up burning the stag. We hear the beginning of their theme, but it, just like at the end of the scene when they were in before, it does not resolve. It does not complete. He looks back in the stands where she was, and she's gone. He looks a little confused at first. The strings come in lower, and they repeat the beginning of the theme. It's 5-6-1. So they do kind of complete it here, but it ends. It's a sad ending. It's like, it's just a kind of a womp womp ending. It's a very weak, sad ending.
So I think I can tell you why he looked confused.
Because she left?
Because his ride back to the airport disappeared.
Oh, you're such a freaking robot.
That's one thing. And then I also thought to myself, that is going to be an awkward road trip back to Boston. I don't know what's worse, if she just left him there or if she waited and drove him back to the airport.
Back to the 18th century North Carolina. I'm wondering if they used the same filming locations in general, not the same like literal piece of land, for the Scottish festival in the 20th century and the place Jamie and Claire were in this episode. It would just be extra sweet if it was, you know, kind of around the same place.
Did you notice the fabric of Claire's skirt?
Didn't it almost look like a little tie-dye?
It kind of looked like homespun camouflage.
Oh.
Like colonial camouflage.
Not tie-dye like super neon tie-dye, but like it, like one color faded into another. That's what it looked like from far away to me.
Look at it again and think camouflage. And I was more concerned with her wet socks than
right?
Wet clothes.
Oh, because I couldn't do that.
I cannot stand wet socks.
Oh, gross. And they're actually quite, if you go on, you know, like walking in them for a long time, they're actually bad for you. They can help cause foot rot. Claire wakes up the next morning and her shoes are gone. And this is great because it's from the book.
I thought we were not going to get that.
Oh, girl.
Like when they first started the sequence of her getting kicked off the horse and finding the shelter, I was like, where are they going to take the shoes? I was like, I guess we're not going to get the shoes. I was excited to still get the shoes.
The music is pretty. It sounded now like an indigenous, I had to say Indian music because that's not what I mean. But, you know, like literally not Indian music because that's like in the Southern Hemisphere. But you know what I mean? Native American flute, if you will. But in indigenous flute, I'm not sure which is the correct term. She walks around and she sees footprints. And she's like, so she grabs this. Of course, she can't go off. She has to grab the skull and opal.
Can't leave your friends.
Because she's Claire, duh. And so she follows the footsteps, footprints, whatever, mud prints. They lead her back to Jamie and the animals. And as soon as she sees him, their love theme starts. It's all over the place, people. Just saying. He says, I'm glad you came back. And she's like, I haven't been here yet. My shoes were missing. And he's like, no, they're right there. I like how they treated this summer. Okay. In the book, they'd already built the cabin. They'd gone out for something. Or excuse me. No, she was attending birth of the Muellers, right? And there was a storm and she should have stayed, but she didn't. She's like, no, I want to get home. So she leaves a little bit too late, crosses this river, makes it across. But in this really bad storm, there's lightning. The whole thing, other than the circumstances of the storm, the rest is very similar. So she has her horse. There's lightning. The tree is on fire. Her horse freaks out and runs away. She falls off, crawls, finds a skull. All the stuff that happened right there pretty much happens. And her shoes disappear. But when she is found by Ian and Jamie and Rollo, the next morning they come find her. It's kind of freaky because they don't say anything until they get back to, or does he bring him with her, with him? He must bring
him
with him.
Yeah, he has him in his sporran. And I remembered thinking, how tiny were her feet?
Oh, yeah, that's funny. So he brings her shoes to her. And it's even freakier. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's cute and it's freaky-ish. It's like a nice nod to the books. But, I mean, it's almost like too trite. Not trite. It's almost too, like, it's just too whatever. In the book, it was freaky as heck. Because someone, the ghost, whatever you want to say, her shoes were on the front porch of their freaking cabin. That's freaky, okay? So anyway, here, but they kept the spirit of it. So her shoes, someone walked her shoes back to Danny. I don't know who Danny is. To Jamie.
Well, he walked him to the creek, and he followed the footsteps to the creek, and she followed the footsteps to the creek. And then when Claire was describing what happened to her the night before, did anyone else think that Jamie was perhaps just plating her?
Oh, for sure. He was like, sure, Claire.
He's like, sure you did.
I think he thinks that she's addled about not having been in this dream. He's like, So she brings it back to where they were before they parted. Those things you said about having nothing to give me. And he's like, don't worry, Sasnak. This is what he says. Don't worry, Sasnak. You should wash. So what you're saying is that Claire is stanky.
But then instead of washing herself, she cleans a skull?
Washes the skull. Yep. And it's important because it was dirty. And also as she tips it over and is scrubbing it or washing the dirt off of it, of course, she finds a few silver fillings. She shouts to Jamie and yep. Dude's a traveler. Dude's a TT. A little sound right here when we see the stuff, they have the conversation. There's a little tease of the Druids theme. Just, it's almost not hard to recognize. It was almost not enough to recognize, but it is there. And when she says the words, quote, someone like me, someone who's traveled through time. It's their theme again. So as she's looking at it, calls Jamie. There's a little bit of a hint of the Dance of the Druids. And then it goes back to Jamie and Claire's theme. And as the shot goes to the skull and then fades out into the next scene, it's dissonance, of course. Skull. I mean, you got to have dissonance. Come on. Okay. Then we're in this beautiful place. And they find, and Jamie names Fraser's Ridge. Book readers will love this scene, this whole back and forth with Monsieur Fraiselier. Mr. Strawberry. I love it.
I thought this was very Adam and Eve.
Oh, heck yeah. That's straight from the books, too. Absolutely.
Because she picked the strawberries and gave them to Jamie.
Oh, clever. Summer. I didn't notice that. I noticed they picked them, but very good. Very, 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 not clever. I mean, clever, too, but very noticey of you. Observant of you.
Look, I don't notice music. I notice okay. This stuff.
I never knocked anybody for not noticing music. Okay, so picture, not when they're in the scene, but this beautiful landscape when they're overlooking, when he's like, that meadow down there and the blah, blah, blah. When they're looking at that, what the viewer is seeing, is that Scotland or is that North Carolina?
It's green screen.
Yeah, but is it green screen North Carolina?
And it looks like a painting.
Of?
It does not look real.
I didn't say it was real. I said, does it remind you?
No, I'm saying it doesn't look real. Like, it doesn't look like a real place. It looks like someone painted it or draw it or designed it.
So this music right here, I'm wondering, it's gorgeous, as most everything is, as they look over this painted fake place of no place. This music here, I'm wondering if this is like the New World theme, or I should say Fraser's Ridge theme, maybe. So it's very happy and hopeful. And then we get the clarinet. So to me, this has to be the New World theme, because the New World for them, of course, is colonial America, 18th century. The New World also, though, 200 years later, is where Brianna and Claire and Frank spend 20 years together. So there's a lot of Frank influence. not so much on Jamie, but on Claire and on Brianna. And of course, because Bree. They both loved Frank in their own way, and Frank loved both in his way. And so then near the end of it, I wrote, or is it an oboe? So I could be wrong here. As always, I can be wrong in anything I say. But I believe it's a clarinet, and it could be an oboe. To me, though, it would be odd to have something that sounds so much like a clarinet when throughout the first three seasons, clarinet completely always is for Frank. So it would be weird to have a different instrument that sounds kind of like a clarinet. So it's like playing something, but not Frank. That's why I think it's a clarinet. And at five minutes and at 55 minutes and 55 seconds, I wrote, this music is crazy good. There's a touch of a banjo pluck. And after Jamie names it, he says, Fraser's Ridge, the music swells and we finally, for the first time in season four, which is after Drums of Autumn, get the drums. Finally. So the final music must be for the New World or the Fraser's Ridge theme, especially with just everything with the drums. And if you sit and watch or listen to the closing where, you know, the credits, that's where you'll hear most of the drums, because after it fades to black, that's where it goes.
And that was episode 403. Join us next week when we will be discussing episode 404 entitled Common Ground.
Thank you, dear listener. As always, if you would like to leave us feedback, and we would love for you to leave us feedback, you can call our listener line at 916-587-0763 or record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us at hello@outlanderpod.com. And we would also love for you to join us and continue the conversation 24/7 in our international community on Facebook. And you can find that at outlanderpod.com/group. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.